feel more satisfying. It's like scratching an itch until it bleeds. It feels so good. That thought had crossed her mind even as she scratched. There had come a moment when she realized that if she did not stop scratching the itch, she would claw herself to death. Something very, very bad had happened to her. The details did not matter. In that moment, she had seen the fire growing exponentially, coming straight for her. In response, she'd created an escape fire. Her escape fire was a story. In this new story, she told herself about herself. She was never simply a victim. For whatever had happened, she bore some responsibility. Whether she did or did not was beside the point. The new story had the very practical effect of shifting the focus from others onto herself, and from things she could not control to things that she could. In this story, she was put on Earth for some purpose, and it was her job not just to figure out what that purpose might be, but to make sure she did not allow herself to become distracted from its fulfillment. The new story had gained focus after she'd taken the job as a local public health officer. Its theme was bravery, and it compelled her to recognize those moments when she was doing, or failing to do, a thing out of fear. Coupled with her natural interests and abilities, it had turned her into an action hero. She believed that, in the bargain, her narrative had saved her life. Soon Charity's purpose was clear, and not only to her, but to anyone who watched her in action. She was put on Earth to fight battles and wars against disease, to save lives and perhaps even an entire country. She'd quit her job as a county health officer and moved to the state because she sensed something big coming that she needed to be there for. Just before she left, she had confided to her friend that she had this feeling she was going to wind up in the White House one day. And when that newly bewildered friend asked why on earth she thought that, she said, "Because I have to fix this." Something big had come, just as she'd imagined in her story. But her office was 15 yards down a hall from where she needed to be, to play the role that she assumed she would play. The feeling of powerlessness had knocked her back hard. She was now reduced to scribbling math on her whiteboard at home at night. By the end of January, when she walked into the building and took the elevator to the 7th floor, she was asking the universe a question. "Why won't you let me do my job?" A bitterness she thought she'd banished had returned. She felt a despair she had not felt in a decade. "I was the lone person in state public health who was saying this is a pandemic," she said. "I wasn't talking to anyone else. I had no validation that I wasn't a crazy person." Then, out of the blue on February 6th, Duane Caneva called her and asked her to have a look at a bunch of old emails. For some reason Charity couldn't fathom, he'd labeled the entire chain Red Dawn. Duane's first working title had been Avengers. However preposterous that sounded, the characters immediately jumped out at her, one more than the others. "This guy Carter," she said. "The way they interacted with him, they clearly thought he was the guru." With help from the others, which consisted mostly of just prodding and teasing, Carter had written these long and curious missives. She read in them an echo of her own thoughts, and then some. They were just incredibly smart and insightful and never-ending. "I wondered how he had time to write all this," recalled Charity. The question I was asking myself reading the emails was, "Doesn't this guy have a job?" It was like 2,000 words on the difference between South Korea's response and Japan's. "He's in the VA, in Atlanta. But he's clearly like the guy with the answers." She looked at the names of the other 6 people on the Red Dawn emails, all men. She'd never heard of any of them, and so the first thing she'd done was to Google them. all doctors, at least two of whom worked inside the Trump administration. Then the names of Carter Mesher and Richard Hatchett finally registered. I said, holy shit, these are the guys who wrote the paper. One of their two papers on the 1918 pandemic, as distinct from the pandemic plan. Charity wouldn't learn that Carter and Richard had written the original pandemic plan for the country until many months later, when someone else told her. Carter and Richard never mentioned it. She'd been energized by Carter and Richard's interpretation of the events of 1918. The takeaway resonated with her experience in Santa Barbara. Social interventions, if done early, could have huge effects on disease transmission. In the extreme, they could contain it. Weeks before, she'd printed out their paper and stuck it in a fat three-ring binder she'd created for herself, her Nerd Bible. Everything in her Nerd Bible was ammunition for the argument she was being forbidden by her boss from making, that the virus had already arrived in the United States, and that it might well lead to a 1918-like pandemic, and that if you wanted to prevent a lot of people from dying, you had better start working at it now. 3 days later, a Sunday, Duane asked her to join them on a conference call. She hadn't responded to the emails. Anything she wrote from her state email account might as well be made public, and she worried what might happen if anyone suspected that she had entered some back-channel conversation with the Trump administration. She'd learned from other battles that there was a fair chance that anything she said, even in private, would end up in the Los Angeles Times. She told Duane that she'd come onto his conference call, but only to listen, not to speak. "I was nervous about being fired for even being on the call," she said. That first call, all these calls, she'd soon learn, started with Duane Kaneva asking Carter Mesher to share his most recent thoughts. "The emails were intriguing," said Charity. "But as soon as Carter started talking, I knew I had found my person." His idea of that moment was something she'd not heard from anyone else. Not healthcare experts, not the CDC, not the armchair epidemiologists on Twitter and cable television, who reminded her of gentlemen farmers who had never actually plowed a field or milked a cow. Carter proposed using the patients with flu-like symptoms who turned up in emergency rooms across the United States as a quick and dirty tool to figure out where the virus was. "Take those numbers and compare them to the seasonal averages, and they might lead you to outbreaks where you could test for the virus. So far, we have only identified two examples where disease spread from a traveler, and in both circumstances, it was very close contact in the household, a spouse," he later wrote, then continued. "Opening up wider surveillance would seem impractical and unnecessary. This conclusion is correct until it is wrong. The problem I see with this approach is the only way we will recognize community transmission is if a contact tracing of a known case, derived from travel screening, finds an extended chain of transmission. But assuming all is well denies the possibility of disease already in the community, just hidden from sight or diagnosis because of a bit of a catch-22. We are in the middle of an active flu season. These cases could look similar to and be confused with flu. Even if a patient presented with fever and lower respiratory tract symptoms and flu tests were negative, CDC will not test these patients for NCOV. So how exactly do you find something that you refuse to look for because you believe it can't be there?" To show the feasibility of his idea, he'd run all these numbers. There were roughly 5,000 hospitals in the United States and 23,000 people a day showing up to them with flu-like symptoms. And so each hospital need only test 5 people each day. If that sounded like too much trouble, you could take a shortcut. By looking for hospitals where the number of people who showed up with flu-like symptoms was rising, while the number of people testing positive for flu was falling. Exactly that was about to occur in New York City, though no one would notice before it was too late. "He sounded like an auto mechanic," said Charity. "Everything he said was really simple, but I kept thinking, oh my God, that's incredibly insightful." He didn't seem to want the spotlight, but his thoughts belonged in the spotlight. At the same time, she didn't understand why she'd been asked to listen in. 2/3 of the way into the call, she figured it out, when Duane, ignoring their understanding, called on her to speak. From the way Duane spoke of her, she realized that he, and they, had somehow gotten it into their heads that she was running California's pandemic response. They also seemed to think that if she made the right moves in California, the state might be used to steer the entire country's response. They knew the CDC had no legal authority to run a pandemic response, but they thought the states had it, she said. "And they thought I personally ran the whole front lines of public health in the state." She had planned to keep quiet, but now didn't want to. "I couldn't stand it," she said. "Here was a group of people who 40 minutes in clearly thought like I did, and clearly wanted to hear what I had to say." Duane Caniva wasn't some nobody. He was chief medical officer of the Department of Homeland Security. He was putting his job at risk. Why shouldn't she? Almost in spite of herself, she began to lay out for the men how, in her view, the world worked. She began by explaining that the local health officers in California, as in certain American states, had real autonomy. She couldn't just make them do whatever she wanted them to do, but had to lead them. "We know what the virus will do," she liked to say. "We don't know what the humans will do." What the humans would do, she felt certain, is what they were led to do, if only they were well led. As she explained the critical role of the local public health office and the need for the state and the federal government to stand behind health officers in their dealings with their communities, her audience on the phone call pushed back against her. "They didn't want to accept it," she said. "Anyone at the federal level is so removed from the shitstorm that is the CDC that they have no clue. They wanted to believe that the CDC or the state could just make local health officers do what they wanted to do. You know why I think they didn't want to accept it? It's too terrifying, too chaotic, too WTF, too much of a shake to federal officials' foundation to digest the truth that local nobodies are really in charge." In effect, she was telling them what she had figured out when she was herself a local public health officer. There was no system of public health in the United States, just a patchwork of state and local health officers, beholden to a greater or lesser degree to local elected officials. 3,500 separate entities that have been starved of resources for the past 40 years. Yes, these local nobodies might allow themselves to be led by a health officer they respected. Say, somebody from the Centers for Disease Control, or a state health officer who knew what she was doing. But the CDC had demonstrated time and again to her that, once the shooting started, it didn't know what to do. Just then, the CDC was supervising the return of Americans from China, and that offered her a case in point. Many of the returning Americans had passed through airports in California, and Charity had seen the ineptitude with which they'd been handled. The CDC hadn't bothered to test them, not even the people returning from Wuhan. When local health officers, her friends and former colleagues, set out to find these possibly infected Americans and make sure that they were following orders to quarantine, they discovered that the CDC officials who had met them upon arrival had not bothered to take down their home addresses. When local officers called the CDC to say how hard it was to track down John Smith when the CDC had listed his residence as Los Angeles International Airport, the CDC said, "Just don't follow up on them." What was the point of having these travel restrictions from Wuhan if the federal government was going to just let people loose upon their return? The CDC was now holding conference calls with the health officers in the cities whose airports had received the returning Americans. Charity's boss tried to block her from speaking with the CDC, but she had gotten herself onto the first of these calls. She'd posed a rude question to the senior CDC official on the call. "How can you keep saying that Americans are at low risk from the virus if you aren't even testing for the virus?" She'd been answered with silence, and then the official moved on to the next topic. "The single most important question is how many undetected cases are out there in our community," said Charity, "and we don't know." Charity thought that the virus was already spreading fast and unseen. Her attempts to sound an alarm in California had gotten her banned by her new boss from participating in discussions about it. There was, in effect, no leadership, either from the state or the federal government. She knew that the weaker-spined local health officers around the country would defer to the CDC, as it got them off the hook for making their own hard decisions. But the better local health officers would not. At least a few local health officers in California, she thought, would summon the nerve to go it on their own. "The peasants will revolt," she said to the Wolverines. Sooner or later, some local health officer would devise her own test and go hunting for the virus and shock everyone and make a mockery of the state of California, the CDC, and the federal government by finding lots of it. That, in any case, is what she would have done were she still a local public health officer. Here was the only place in her little speech where the men had seriously interrupted her. They simply could not or did not want to believe that in a crisis, any local health officer would not defer to the CDC, or if the CDC was asleep at the switch, the state of California. "You don't know who you are talking to," she said. "I was that local health officer." After that, they just let her speak, and when she'd finished speaking, she realized that she had just sort of let rip in a way she'd never intended. She hadn't told them what she thought of her new boss or the CDC. She'd tried simply to describe the CDC's actions without offering her editorial opinion. Still, she had let them know that, however bad they might imagine the situation on the ground to be, it was worse. She wondered how long it would take before word got out about what she'd said, and she got in serious trouble with her superiors for ignoring the chain of command and working behind their backs. "I thought that was really intense," she said. Soon after that first call, James Lawler was asked by the Department of Health and Human Services to fly to Japan, extract the 430 American citizens who were on the Diamond Princess, load them onto cargo planes, and fly with them back home. Though he didn't work for the Department of Health and Human Services, he didn't give it a second thought. Lawler called his friend and honorary Wolverine, Michael Callahan, and asked him to join him. And after stuffing a giant pile of negative pressure helmets into seven giant duffel bags, the two set off for Japan the next morning. Seeing this made the decision about whether to throw in with this preposterously named group of men much easier for Charity. "It made me like them," she said. "It was action, not white papers." She still wasn't entirely sure what to make of the men, or what the men made of her, or what she'd said. But soon, one of them sent her a message. "Where did you come from?" Another began to refer to her as Wolverette. "We liked her right away," Carter said. "She's Spitfire." 9. The L6. The names at the top of the Red Dawn emails grew in both number and importance. Charity thought of it as the Carter Show and noticed that, even though Carter Mesher supplied almost all of the interesting material, he demanded none of the attention. It was never, look at me, but always, look at this. The audience for Carter's analysis would come to include the health officers of a bunch of states and a pack of current and former Trump administration officials, including Tom Bossert, the Surgeon General, Jerome Adams, and Trump's White House doctor turned presidential advisor, Ronnie Jackson. A small crowd inside the Department of Health and Human Services also joined, among them Bob Catlick, who ran ASPR, the office responsible for responding to medical emergencies. Charity watched as important men took insights and data generated by Carter at his bedroom desk and repeated them on television and Twitter as their own. Everyone is cheating off Carter, she said, but Carter did not seem at all to mind. Just the reverse. He told everyone to take what they wanted and insisted that he had no special claim on anything he wrote. Then there were the phone calls. The emails were where people turned to listen to Carter's mind at work. During the conference calls, held on weekends, people felt safe to voice their own private thoughts that might get them into public trouble. Charity found this a bit odd, as it was not at all clear who was on these calls or how safe it was to say anything. There were always 14 people lurking who never identified themselves, she said. I was never sure who was listening. On the line at various times, she later learned, were Tony Fauci, White House staffers, and members of the president's coronavirus task force. By some mechanism, Charity never fully understood, the things she said on these calls could have real effects. During one call in mid-February, she railed about the idiocy of the CDC's requirement that to qualify for a COVID-19 test, an American needed to be in an ICU with a history of travel to China. The disease was clearly already spreading inside the United States. There were almost surely people walking around with it who had not traveled to China and had no symptoms. How on earth would it ever be controlled if local health officers couldn't test, at the very least, people with flu-like symptoms? A week or so after she'd vented, the CDC changed its definition of a person under investigation to include severely ill people with no travel history. They did it in like a footnote in 8-point type, said Charity. It felt passive-aggressive. Good job, Charity, Carter wrote that very day, at the end of one of his long emails to the group. They just added your footnote. What Charity couldn't figure out was how, or even if, what she said on the calls found its way into the ears of the decision makers, and who those people were. At one point, she put the question to James Lawler. James, she asked, who exactly is in charge of this pandemic? Nobody, he replied. But if you want to know who is sort of in charge, it's sort of us. To the new and growing group of people sort of in charge of the pandemic, Carter found himself explaining all over again the truths that he and Richard and Lisa and Bob and Laura Glass had discovered 14 years earlier. I want to pass along some slides that help explain what we mean by early targeted and layered interventions, he began in an email in early February, then explained the effects of school closures and social distancing and the rest. He walked the crowd through the different outcomes in Philadelphia and St. Louis and how they should think of Wuhan as Philly and the United States as having a shot at becoming St. Louis. He went right away to his favorite analogy. One could think of the interventions like a fire extinguisher, he wrote. It will be effective if the fire is caught early, say only a grease fire on the top of a stove. But once the fire has spread and half the house is ablaze, you can empty the fire extinguisher, but it won't do much. Probably as effective as just throwing it through a window. The problem with implementing the social interventions too late is you get all the downsides and little benefit, so speed is critical. The challenge is that they need to be implemented before things get bad. By the time people realized that their house was on fire, they needed more than a fire extinguisher. The trick was to learn how to smell smoke. To Carter, that was the beauty of the Diamond Princess. The American authorities were either unable or unwilling to smell the smoke. A lot of people seem to be viewing events in Wuhan as just one of those bizarre things that happened in China. Isn't it odd how they throw up an entire 1,000-bed hospital over a weekend? Chinese data was sketchy and possibly unreliable. That was true, but the view of the fire on board the Diamond Princess could not be clearer. The 2,666 passengers are similar in age and likely in comorbidities to the population we see in a nursing home or a residential care facility, wrote Carter. The 1,045 crew are a proxy for a young, healthy population. He pulled the ship's itinerary and reconstructed what had happened on board, day by day. The Diamond Princess had left Yokohama on January 20th. 5 days later, it docked in Hong Kong, where an 80-year-old passenger disembarked. On February 1st, the passenger, still in Hong Kong, tested positive for the new coronavirus. The ports for which the cruise ship was headed canceled its certificates of landing. On February 3rd, the Diamond Princess chugged back into Tokyo Bay and its port of origin. 2 days later, the first passenger tested positive. 2 days after that, the number of confirmed positives reached 61 people. Think about this, Carter wrote on February 9th. If that 80-year-old man had instead flown to the U.S., stayed for 5 days and then flown home and was found to have NCOV, do you think we would have identified the 61 cases through our usual approach? Look at the details. This 80-year-old wasn't even from China. He wouldn't have even qualified under our definition for a PUI to be tested. We would have missed the entire cluster. At that moment, there was essentially no COVID-19 testing inside the United States. The Food and Drug Administration was still insisting that state and local health officers wait for the test kits supplied by the CDC. And the CDC was still saying that the risk to Americans from the virus was very low. The entire country was dismissing what the redneck epidemiologist had glimpsed in Wuhan. The Japanese weren't dismissing it, though. The Japanese were alert. They had their own labs and planned to use them to test everyone on board the cruise ship. Until then, Carter had felt a bit like a man searching a dark cave with a match. The Japanese were about to wheel in floodlights. The cave was the cruise ship, but not only the cruise ship. The cave, thought Carter, was his own mind. The picture that he had created in his head about Wuhan, pieced together from news reports, was not reality, but some version of it, distorted by forces beyond his control. We were constantly triangulating and we were constantly reminding ourselves that the models in our heads could be wrong, reminding ourselves to not make the same mistake, he said. There were so many parallels to patient safety and error. The strategy of layered and partially overlapping defenses that he'd used to reduce deadly mistakes inside American hospitals, he now applied to his own thoughts. Of course he knew that a cruise ship stuck in Tokyo Bay with 3,711 people aboard, confined to their cabins, was an artificial social environment. A virus on board a ship would spread differently than it would, say, in an American city. But it could still say a lot about what the virus might do inside an American city. Most importantly, how likely it was to kill. For the first and perhaps only time in the calculation of the percentage of infected who died, They'd be able to see not just the numerator, but also the real denominator. They'd know exactly how many had been infected. Over the next 3 days, the case count on board the ship rose from 61 to 135. The numbers shocked even Carter. "This is unbelievable," he wrote. "We are so far behind the curve." He laid out side by side the first 10 days of the 2009 swine flu outbreak against what had already happened on the cruise ship. Swine flu had been so frightening because it spread so fast. This new virus was spreading much faster. Over the next 10 days, the numbers grew exponentially. On February 16th, when Lawler and Callahan evacuated 329 Americans from the ship, the count reached 355. By February 19th, when the first two passengers died, 621 people were infected. 2 days after that, Carter found, on the website of Japan's National Institute of Infectious Diseases, a field report filled with data from the cruise ship. "I can't understand why no one is paying attention to this," he said. "It's a gold mine." The level of detail in the report about the spread of the virus was new. It described not only how many had been infected, but their ages, when they had first exhibited symptoms, and the number of people with whom they shared a cabin. It gave the dates they first exhibited symptoms. It revealed that 51% of those who tested positive were asymptomatic. Carter took that number with a large grain of salt, as the infection in many was new, and they might still develop symptoms. Still, it was an astonishing number. Up to that point, there had been no study of asymptomatic spread. The cruise ship was dramatizing just how stealthy the virus might be, and also helping to explain what appeared, in Wuhan, to be a truly fantastic rate of transmission. "The only way I make sense of things is through stories that I tell myself," Carter had written to his new audience of total strangers a few days earlier, as an excuse to tell them all over again about the Man Gulch fire. "What has me worried is that what happened on the cruise ship is a preview of what will happen when the virus makes its way to the U.S. healthcare system, not to mention institutionalized high-risk populations in the U.S., like nursing homes. I'm not sure that folks understand what is just over the horizon. Remember the story about Man Gulch? We are at the equivalent of about 554. I anticipate that when we reach 545, there is going to be chaos and panic to get anything in place. I doubt that what we would then hurriedly put in place will be any better than what they did on that cruise ship." The report gave Carter a more complete real-time picture of the virus inside a community than anything he'd seen or was ever likely to see. That new data served as a check against the model in his head, the narrative that he'd been constructing since he first started poking around the internet in China. The attack rate on the Diamond Princess was 20%. Within a month, 1 in 5 of the people confined to their rooms had been infected. That would be on the extreme low end of the likely attack rate over a longer period of time in a more natural setting. But it lined up with his mental model. All that remained was the calculation of the death rate. In Wuhan, that was tricky, as it was impossible to know just how many people had been infected. Now it was tricky because most of the people who were going to die on the cruise ship hadn't done it yet. It could take as long as 3 weeks for the end to come, and Carter didn't think he had 3 weeks. He resorted again to redneck epidemiology. The seriously ill pretty quickly landed in intensive care units, he reasoned, either in Japan or in the home countries to which they had returned. Carter followed the news reports about them and tracked their progress. It was a strange and quixotic hunt, but in the end, he made an accurate count of the number of passengers on the Diamond Princess who had wound up in ICUs. He also knew the mortality rates for patients in ICUs with all causes of respiratory failure. between a quarter and a half of them died. By assuming that the passengers on the Diamond Princess in ICUs would die at the same rates as the others, he got a rough idea of the lethality of the new disease before the deaths had actually occurred. The infection fatality rate on the ship, Carter reckoned, fell somewhere between 1.5% and 2%. Its population skewed older than the American population, but you could, and he did, take those numbers and adjust them by assigning different mortality rates to different age groups in the United States. Once he'd finished, he had an infection fatality rate of between 0.5% and 1%. The redneck epidemiology he'd done in Wuhan would have predicted the outcomes on the Diamond Princess. I think this data is close enough to convince people that this is going to be bad, and we will need to pull the full array of NPIs, social interventions, wrote Carter on February 28th. All that is left is when. Timing. Back in 1918, St. Louis had introduced social interventions 1 week after the first local cases, he pointed out. Philadelphia had waited 3 weeks. Already there were cities in the United States behind St. Louis, and maybe even behind Philadelphia. We should be treating this like we treat strokes and acute coronary syndromes where time equals tissue, wrote Carter. In this case, time equals transmission. He had the right mental model for the virus. The glitch was in his mental model of his own country and its leadership. Every day brought him more evidence of their unwillingness to act on what he'd seen. On February 26th, President Trump announced at a press conference that only 15 Americans had been infected with the virus and that when you have 15 people and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down close to zero, that's a pretty good job we've done. The next evening, taking questions after a White House meeting with African American leaders, Trump had simply declared, "It's going to disappear. One day, it's like a miracle, it will disappear." The CDC, for its part, lagged about 5 steps behind where it should be. On March 1st, it announced that the United States would screen people arriving from other countries for symptoms of the virus. "I wouldn't waste a moment of time on travel restrictions or travel screening," Carter wrote. "We have nearly as much disease here in the U.S. as the countries in Europe." Every passing moment could be measured in lives lost, and yet, a week after Carter had all the confirmation he needed for his mental model of the threat, nothing had changed. "I sense confusion among very smart people," he wrote in early March. "They hear that more than 80% of those who are infected have mild disease, and that overall, case fatality rates are on the order of 0.5%. And then they equate these states to a mild outbreak. To help people get their head around what is perceived to be a mild outbreak," he ran some numbers. Using the most conservative assumptions suggested by the cruise ship, an attack rate of 20% and a fatality rate of 0.5%, you wound up with 330,000 dead Americans. Carter was by nature conciliatory, the sort of person who, after his car is rear-ended, wonders if perhaps he hadn't hit his brakes too suddenly. He was forever looking at any problem or dispute from the other person's point of view. It wasn't easy to get him into the state of mind in which he found himself by mid-March. "I notice a lot of HHS, Department of Health and Human Services, addresses on this email in group," he wrote on the 11th. "You all have been quiet for most of the discussion over the past several weeks. I would urge you to read the article I just sent out and upbrief your boss. History will long remember what we do and what we don't at this critical moment. It is time to act, and it is past the time to remain silent. This outbreak isn't going to magically disappear on its own." He liked to imagine himself 2 weeks into the future, looking back on the moment and asking himself, "Knowing what I know now, What do I wish I had done back then? In the early stages of a pandemic, the question was especially pointed. At least once the reproductive rate of the virus is known, it isn't that hard to see what you might know 2 weeks from today. Some multiple of today's infections. But if you lacked the will or the ability to test for the virus, those numbers could be truly shocking. Italy was just then illustrating the point. Back on February 20th, a grand total of 3 COVID-19 cases had been discovered in the whole of the country. None of the infected were seriously ill. By March 13th, the Italian case count had gone to 17,660, with 1,328 people in intensive care, and 1,266 dead. What would CDC guidance have advised Italy to do on February 21st? Carter wrote. How would CDC have described what was going on in Italy? Would this have met their definition of widespread community transmission? I doubt it. CDC and the CDC modeler would have recommended sitting tight. He sent emails to people inside the CDC. But they were all tight-lipped. It was a black box. On March 15th, after the CDC suggested both that gatherings of more than 50 people should be avoided for the next 8 weeks, and that schools should remain open, Carter went off. That CDC would not want 50 people being together for even an hour, while hundreds of thousands of kids could be together for 8 hours, defies common sense, he wrote. Imagine CDC getting on TV and trying to explain. Good luck with that. He'd now awakened to the possibility that at least one of his mental models badly distorted reality. His model of American government. People who might be led to prepare for what was coming were being led not to. One morning in early March, Carter and his wife, Deborah, went shopping in the Atlanta exurbs. A few months before, they would have been shopping for groceries. Now they were hunting for the supplies that Carter suspected would soon be scarce. As Deborah shopped, Carter watched. I said, look how carefree everyone is. In a week or two, everything is going to change, and these people have no idea what is about to happen. Debbie is looking at me, and she said, maybe that's a good thing, not to know what's about to happen. Charity Dean had been living for years with a mental model that fit exactly with the facts on the ground. Her model started with two assumptions. One, something was coming. Two, the CDC wouldn't deal with it. The CDC reminded Charity of a person who allows a false but flattering story about himself to circulate. If everyone has somehow come to believe that you speak French fluently, why contradict them? What does it matter that people keep saying that you played wide receiver on your high school football team when really you only caught a few passes in gym class? The CDC had allowed people to believe that they were battlefield commanders, that, in a pandemic, they'd actually run the show. How that rumor got started, Charity neither knew nor cared. What she cared about suddenly was this rogue group of patriots who were working behind the scenes to save the country. They captured her imagination and lifted her spirits. When I met Carter, it was a game changer, she said. I was no longer a crazy person. I got more of a spring in my step, more of a fuck it attitude. That new attitude found its highest expression in her interactions with the boss, who was acting like a shill for the CDC. One day as she dressed for work, she swapped her usual battle armor of dark suit and grandma heels for sneakers and a t-shirt that read, "Not today, Satan." I was obnoxious, she said. I'd walk into her office and put Carter's graphs on her desk. She used the word pandemic. She left her math on her whiteboard and encouraged others to stop by and see it. She further ignored her boss's order to never put thoughts or recommendations into an email. Email created a record, explained Charity. she began to put her thoughts in emails. For instance, after the state of Washington on February 28th reported its first COVID-19 case that could not be explained either by travel from China or contact with some person known to have been infected by the virus. With the virus openly spreading in Greater Seattle, Charity wrote an email to her boss suggesting that the Western states, California, Oregon, and Washington, seize the moment to form a coalition. They would stop waiting for the CDC to create a test for COVID-19 that actually worked and create their own test using their own laboratories. The three states together would have a credibility that no state on its own could generate. She called me at 9 at night and started screaming at me about having put it in an email, recalled Charity. Her nerd Bible grew fatter by the day. It became a kind of weapon. In addition to the greatest hits from American medical journals, it held one of Carter and Richards' two papers about the 1918 pandemic, plus the papers that Bob Glass had written with his daughter about the use of models to study the effectiveness of various social interventions. She'd crash meetings that her boss didn't want her to attend and announce her arrival by dropping this huge binder on the table. Boom! Charity was struck by how little interest people had in some of its contents. The analyses of the events of 1918, for instance. She could get her colleagues' attention with Neil Ferguson's latest analysis out of Imperial College, which looked, to Charity, like an academically respectable version of what Carter had been doing in emails. But when she tried to show what the country might learn from the last time it was overrun by a disease, people listened with the wary indulgence of the sane in the presence of a fanatic. I realized there was this arrogance or unwillingness to even fathom that America in 1918 might know more about this than we do right now, said Charity, that 1918 had nothing to teach us, but it did. She was now going back and forth privately with maybe 20 of the 58 local California health officers. She knew them all, in one way or another, and thought of herself more as one of them than anything else. They supplied her with a steady flow of on-the-ground intelligence, and she, in return, told them what she thought they might do to compensate for the lack of action by the federal and state governments. She thought they should use their labs to create their own COVID-19 tests, for instance, and make their own decisions about how to use them. I was basically encouraging them to go rogue because the state's chief health officer is Team CDC, she said. And they all asked the same question. How bad is it going to be? I said, doomsday. And they'd say, the state's not saying that. Charity knew, or thought she knew, what needed to be done for the state to have any shot at containing the new virus. In her head, up until the end of February, was a plan not just to limit the damage caused by the virus, but to contain the virus. Containment, not mitigation, had always been what interested her. I didn't want to manage it, she said. I wanted to beat it. Her ambition to contain was not simply a strategy, but an expression of a deep character trait. It was why each flu season she lost interest the moment it became clear that there were no dangerous mutations to monitor. It was why, in the biography of Winston Churchill she was reading, she'd never gotten past the Munich Agreement. That was the moment Germany ceased to be a problem of containment and became one of mitigation. A number of countries had set out to contain the new virus. Charity admired them for that. She thought that the United States should have had the good sense to emulate them. The state of California should close its borders with other states, she believed, until it figured out exactly how much virus was circulating and where. It should blow open testing and allow every microbiology lab to develop its own test. It should test anyone turning up at any hospital with flu-like symptoms. She'd borrow for California the smartest strategies being used by Asian countries. Thailand required anyone entering the country to wear a GPS wristband. That ensured that people obeyed the quarantine rules and also told you, if they didn't, whom they might have infected. Singapore was using law enforcement to escort people to their place of quarantine and ensure that they remained there for 14 days. Those requiring isolation included every new arrival to the country. That's what you do in TB control, Charity said. The nurses take them to a hotel room and the sheriff watches them. If you think you have a shot at containing it, that's what you do. You have to do it by health officer authority. People say you can't do it, but we do it every day for TB. Japan was doing something clever with their contact tracing. Perhaps from their close view of the Diamond Princess, public health authorities had figured out early that super spreaders played a far bigger role in the explosion of COVID-19 than in, say, the spread of flu. It wasn't clear why, but never mind why. Why you could worry about later. Why the CDC could write a paper about. The practical effect was that a relative handful of people played an outsized role in the spread of the disease. Most people gave it to no one. A handful gave it to 20 other people. When the Japanese health authorities found a new case, they did not waste their energy asking the infected person for a list of contacts over the previous few days to determine whom the person might have infected in turn. Again, most people with COVID-19 infected no one. Instead, they asked for a list of people with whom the infected person had interacted further back in time. Find the person who had infected the newly infected person, and you might have found a super spreader. Find a super spreader, and you could track down the next super spreader before she really got going. You could stamp out embers before they turned into big fires. Charity thought that the governor should hold a daily video press conference in which he took questions from the public and explained, in the event that the virus proved impossible to contain, exactly when and why he would impose various social interventions, school closures, a ban on mass gatherings, and so on. The trigger points go right back to the 2007 pandemic plan, said Charity. I thought that people could handle the bad news so long as you're straight with them. What they don't like is uncertainty. Say, here's where we are, and everyone needs to understand that this is going to get really bad. You tell them what is going to happen, so they can emotionally prepare for it. One evening, in a cold sweat, she marched into Sonya Angel's office and told her all this, and what she, the chief health officer of the state of California, should say to the governor. You need to say, stand up a plan or fire me now. And if it doesn't work, you can fire me then. But then Charity took an odd view of the state health officer's job. The role of the state health officer in California is to have someone to fire, she said. She now watched what happened when the health officer declined to accept that role. On February 19th, the UC Davis Medical Center admitted a patient who had symptoms and no history of travel, and so did not meet the CDC's criteria for testing. In any case, the hospital did not have the ability to test. For that matter, no one in Sacramento County had the ability to test. By then, Zimbabwe could test, but California could not because of the CDC, said Charity. Zimbabwe! The hospital sent a sample to the CDC in Atlanta on February 23rd, and the CDC returned a positive diagnosis, but not until February 26th. Even then, they failed to flag it as a community transmission, but lumped it in, unremarked upon, with the test results of people who had returned to California from China or some cruise ship. It was the director of the California State Lab, Deb Watford, who caught the oversight. In the 7 days between February 19th and February 26th, hospital workers had been exposed to the new virus without knowing it. In those 7 days, it was possible to have known that the virus was not just a threat from the outside, but was already traveling from person to person inside the United States. February 23rd was a Sunday. The following morning, Sonia Angel held a conference call with the health officers from California's 58 counties. "This is among friends," recalled one of those health officers. "No one else here but us health officers." Sonia got on the call and took a very distant approach. She said, "I'm not at liberty to share the details of the case." We were like, "What?" There were no rules preventing the state health officer from sharing the details of a case with other public health officers. The medical privacy laws did not apply. The patient by then had been moved to the ICU at UC Davis Medical Center and was on a ventilator. The health officers needed to know her symptoms and how they'd progressed. They needed to know who she was so they might trace her contacts. They needed to know all kinds of details so they might keep people from dying while they gathered the resources to fight the new pathogen. The patient had come from Solano County, and the health officers from the surrounding counties grew apoplectic. To me, it sort of betrayed a complete lack of understanding of what was meant to happen between state and local health officers, said one. Speaking of Angel, she added, she botched it right out of the gate. From that moment, no one trusted her. Donald Trump had said that it was every state for itself. And that one phone call, the Newsom administration had signaled to the local health officers that it was every county for itself, too. They would learn the lesson Charity had been forced to learn during her time as a local health officer. No one's coming to save you. Charity had been excluded by Angel from any calls with the local health officers, so she only knew what happened when they began to call her and holler into the phone. But she noticed when the CDC made a curious pivot from downplaying the virus to behaving as if it never could have been contained. For the better part of 2 months, they'd repeated the same mantra. The risk to Americans is low, and there is no evidence of transmission inside the country. That fiction ended on February 25th, when the CDC's lab in Atlanta identified as positive for COVID-19 the patient inside the UC Davis Medical Center with no history of foreign travel. That day, the CDC's Nancy Messonnier held a press conference to say that the spread of the disease was inevitable. "It's not so much a question of if this will happen anymore," she said, "but rather more a question of exactly when this will happen and how many people in this country will have severe illness." The stock market dropped 1,100 points, and Trump ranted and raved, thus frightening everyone else in the CDC into silence and turning Messonnier into a martyr. An order came from Vice President Mike Pence's office saying that henceforth, no one in the Department of Health and Human Services was allowed to say anything that might alarm the public. People were soon saying how brave Messonnier had been to say that the virus could not be stopped. To Charity, her words sounded like the CDC letting itself off the hook for failing even to try. To Charity, it looked as if Sonia Angel had declined to discuss the case of local transmission to give the CDC time to appear to be on top of the situation by announcing it first. By then, she and her boss weren't speaking to each other unless speech could not be avoided. Then, suddenly, that didn't matter so much. Charity had found another, more important audience. On a Red Dawn phone call in early March, she was laying out her ideas about what California and every state in the country should do when a new voice came on the line. "This is Ken," it said. Ken Cuccinelli, the acting Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security and a member of Trump's coronavirus task force. He said, "Charity, you need to push these things through. You're the only one who can do this." She was taken aback by his insistence. He wasn't pleading with me to do the right thing. He was yelling at me. He was basically implying that the White House is not going to do the right thing. The White House is not going to protect the country. So California needs to take the lead. That was the moment she learned that the White House was listening in on the calls, and also the moment when she realized just how lost and desperate the people at the top were. He's the Deputy Director of Homeland Security. He can just go talk to the president. And he's relying on some random blonde girl to save the country. Really? A system was groping toward a solution, but the solution required someone in it to be brave, and the system didn't reward bravery. It was stuck in an infinite loop of first realizing that it was in need of courage, and then remembering that courage didn't pay. Charity didn't think of it this way, but it was striking how often the system returned to her and very nearly sought her leadership without ever formally acknowledging its need. On March 6th, Gavin Newsom convened 100 of the state's top officials to discuss the new coronavirus. Sonia Angel had told Charity that she, Angel, would give the briefing to the governor, and that it was better if Charity did not attend the meeting. "You have no role," Angel explained, "so you should not be there." Charity didn't believe Angel had the ability to get up in front of the audience and explain what was going on. "I just had a feeling that something would happen and she wouldn't be able to make it," she recalled. Sure enough, the morning of the event, the phone call came. Angel couldn't make the meeting. Might Charity step in at the last minute to replace her? She spoke for 20 minutes. What she said would have been completely familiar to anyone who had read the collected works of Carter Mesher. It was, "This is what is coming, and these are the options." It was just math, but the reason I was willing to speak up so loudly was because of Carter. Governor Newsom and others asked questions of her for 45 minutes. Afterward, maybe 20 people came up to talk to her. "Oh my gosh," one had said to her, "someone actually knows the answers." Days later, she received a call from Mark Ghilarducci, who ran all of California's emergency services. He asked her to fly down to Oakland to supervise the unloading of the Grand Princess, another cruise ship overrun by COVID-19. "I'm the one who rescued you from the attic," tell her later. And later, to Charity, that sounded about right. In Oakland, she found herself in a room inside a FEMA tent, with a whiteboard and a gaggle of Newsom's most important advisors. She offered to show them the math of epidemics, and they accepted. She proceeded to lay out the deceptions of any disease that is spreading exponentially, especially when large numbers of people with it have no symptoms and you have no ability to test. "The only clear signal you get from the virus is death. In the beginning, you have just one death, the first death, and really, that seems like not such a big deal. But once you realize that only half of 1% of the people who get the disease die, you can surmise that for every death, there are 199 people already walking around with it. That first death, which California already had experienced, was telling you that you had 200 cases a month earlier. And so you had to ask how rapidly those 200 cases had been multiplying." The world's best redneck epidemiologist, Charity didn't mention Carter Mesher, but he was now a voice in her head, had figured out that each person who got the virus was infecting 2 to 3 others. Out of caution, you had to assume a reproductive rate of 3. Every week, the number of infections triples. Do the math and play it out across a California population with 0 immunity. And 7 weeks from today, you'd have 11,809,800 cases. As much as 10% or so of those people, more than 1 million Californians, would need a hospital bed. Half of 1%, or a bit more than 59,000 people, would die. All that from one death. Yes. It was just one death, but if you looked closely, you could see that it did not look like a simple event. It looked like the fire coming up the hill in Man Gulch. "This isn't theoretical," she told the group. "This is exactly what is going to happen. It's what happened back in 1918. Of course, she continued, that was only true if the state did nothing to stop the virus. Carter liked to say that there was no such thing as an unmitigated pandemic. Even if the government did nothing, people would adapt their social behavior to the virus. But whatever people did, Charity explained, the story ended only with a vaccine or herd immunity. There was no vaccine in sight, and the number of infections required to achieve herd immunity could be calculated, as it was a simple function of the reproductive rate. The formula was 1 minus 1 over R0, where R0 was the reproduction number. The simple truth that the formula captured, the more transmissible the disease, the more people needed to be infected before the herd was theoretically safe. Measles' reproductive rate of 18, on the high end, implies that 95% of the population needs to be immune to measles before measles stops spreading. That's why we have as our goal to vaccinate 95% of the population against measles. Before COVID-19 stopped spreading, 2/3 of Californians would need to become infected. It was just a bunch of numbers on a whiteboard, but Charity sensed that, at the very least, she'd held the attention of the governor's senior advisors. A few days later, the Secretary of California's Health and Human Services Agency, Mark Galley, called her. Galley had hired Sonia Angel to run the California Department of Public Health. Several times in January and February, he'd told Charity that she needed to obey the chain of command and convey anything she had to say through her immediate boss. Going forward, he now said Charity should report directly to him. In mid-March, a technology entrepreneur named Todd Park sent a note to a friend who served as Governor Newsom's economic advisor and told him to call if he needed anything. Without a lot of noise or publicity, Park had created 3 different billion-dollar healthcare technology companies and then gone on to serve for 3 years under President Obama as the country's chief technology officer. He had a reputation for fixing other people's messes without drawing attention to himself, and so had made himself popular with public figures without ever really becoming one himself. Newsom's economic advisor called Park immediately and asked him if he could help the state figure out what to do about the coronavirus. Park recruited a pair of former Obama administration officials, Bob Kocher, a doctor turned venture capitalist who had advised Obama about healthcare, and DJ Patil, who had served as the country's first chief data scientist. I wrote about DJ Patil in The Fifth Risk. Working with a friend at LinkedIn and needing a description for a new kind of job in the economy, DJ had coined the phrase data scientist. Patil pulled together a team of some of the best programmers in Silicon Valley, and the team instantly began to collect data that would help them to project and predict. In a couple of days, they had everything from the number of beds in intensive care units to data from toll booths and cell phone companies that gave them a feel for how people moved around inside the state. No one cares about data when everything is going well, said Josh Wills, the former chief data engineer at Slack, who agreed to help. People only care about data when the shit hits the fan. Oh my God, what's going on? We need data. The people who had managed data and technology for the entire United States government became volunteer workers for the state of California. Park and Patil and Kocher drove to Sacramento, where they were met by Newsom's technology advisor, Mike Wilkening, who had been among those to watch Charity Dean at a whiteboard doing the math that showed how and when the new coronavirus would explode in California. Park and Patil knew how to build models to analyze data, but they knew nothing about communicable disease. None of the state's data was of any use to a decision maker without some assumptions about the virus, its reproductive rate, its hospitalization rate, its infection fatality rate, and so on. The only data points we had were China, 2 cruise ships and some early stuff from Italy, said Patil. They'd need to make lots of educated guesses, not just about the virus, but about the effect on its transmission of different policies. Closing schools, say, or banning large gatherings. We told Wilkening that we need the most kick-ass public health guru, And he said, "I know the person," said Park. And it turned out to be Charity. They found her in a conference room inside a dull state office building. "She had this incredibly thick binder," said Park. And she said, "I've been keeping this binder since early January." Charity walked them through what had happened back in 1918 and what was happening again, in only slightly different form. She explained how, 6 weeks earlier, she had arrived at a fairly good estimate of all the important traits of the virus. And she said that once you knew these things about the virus, you could predict its future. She did not tell them that she had spent the previous 6 weeks in conversations with maybe the world's greatest redneck epidemiologist. Park and Patil mostly just listened to her and asked questions. At some point, Park turned to Patil and said, "She's the L6. In Park's time with the federal government, he'd dealt with one technology crisis after another. He'd noticed a pattern that he'd first identified in the private sector. In any large organization, the solution to any crisis was usually found not in the officially important people at the top, but in some obscure employee far down the organization's chart. A case in point was the day the software used by the State Department to process visa applications stopped working. That day, the U.S. government simply lost its ability to issue visas. Park sent in a team to figure out why. They called me and said, 6 layers down from the people in charge, we found 2 contractors who actually understand what is broken. The L6. The person buried under 6 layers of organization whose muzzled voice suddenly, urgently, needed to be heard. I got the feeling that she hadn't been at the table, said Park of Charity. It was clear that this was the moment that she had been preparing for her entire life, and that she was finding it incredibly frustrating that she wasn't being allowed to help. After a couple of hours with Charity, Park and Patil decided that the most useful thing they could do for the state of California was to deliver the contents of her mind onto Gavin Newsom's desk. "Our only job was to make it possible for Charity to talk through a model," recalled Park. "Our job was to take everything in her brain and get it to the governor." To Charity, at the time, he said, "I want you to understand. I think we were sent here to find you." On the one hand, it made sense to Charity. She actually was an L6. 4 layers of bureaucracy separated her from Governor Newsom, the L1. On the other hand, she was no one's idea of a timid soul, waiting for someone to discover that she knew how to contain and control a communicable disease better than anyone else in California's state government. She wasn't some shrinking violet. She was a massive bouquet of red roses delivered with a singing telegram. She popped. It told you something about big organizations and the L6s buried inside them, that they were able to turn Charity Dean into a person in need of excavation. Charity actually didn't trust computers and was uneasy with models beyond the math on her whiteboard. She watched Park and Patil bring a team together to rewrite the code of a disease forecasting model created at Johns Hopkins so that it ran much faster and incorporated lots of data about California. And how they did this, she had not the faintest clue. She was strangely relieved to see that once you plugged in what she and Carter knew or thought they knew about the virus, the new computer model regurgitated the coming disaster they imagined. That view happened to be radically different from the official position of the CDC, the White House, and for that matter, the state of California. Before Park had traveled to Sacramento, Governor Newsom's advisors had sent him an Excel spreadsheet with some calculations made by someone inside their public health department. These showed the virus never generating so much illness that the state's 75,000 hospital beds couldn't handle. "I don't know who did it," said Park, "but it was all wrong." The new model suggested that if no action were taken to minimize the virus's spread, the state would need 700,000 hospital beds by the middle of May. It gave us a very fast answer, and we can see that we're fucked, said Patil. We're going to blow through the hospital beds. However, if the state acted as, say, St. Louis had acted back in 1918, hospitalizations would peak at around 70,000. That is, various social interventions would reduce infections, hospitalizations, and deaths to a tenth of what they otherwise would have been. On March 18th, Park and Patil presented the model's output to Governor Newsom's senior advisors. When we showed them what the model was saying, it sucked the air out of the room, said Park. The next day, Governor Newsom issued the country's first statewide stay-at-home order. At his press conference, he said that the decision was based upon some new information. It was pretty cool, said Josh Wills, who wrote the software. I got to see Governor Newsom tweet out some charts I made. If you Googled Charity Dean at that moment, the way she had Googled the men on the Red Dawn emails, you'd have found not much more than a couple of grainy pictures of her at a reunion of her Tulane medical school class. You might have found a few old columns she wrote for the Santa Barbara Independent and some videos of her testifying in front of the Santa Barbara Board of Supervisors and some vicious attacks on her by the local anti-vaxxers.